Every single person who's not indigenous to this land is an immigrant, or they come from immigrants. How do you decipher who you choose to send away?
Native shareholders question their corporation's migrant detention contracts. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Friday, March 28th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, state lawmakers pass a bill designating March as Women's History Month in Alaska.
The purpose is to lift up, recognize, and integrate women's experiences into our state's narrative.
An Alaska Native Corporation's shareholders are questioning contracts that one of its subsidiaries has to run migrant detention facilities. That's as the Trump administration's immigration crackdown continues. Nana Regional Corporation subsidiary Acoma has faced accusations in recent national news stories about the poor treatment of migrants at detention facilities it runs. Jackie Catalina Schaefer is a Nana shareholder and former board member. She says there's been a lack of transparency from Nana leadership about the contracts.
You know, we are Inupiaq from Northwest Arctic that are founded on Inupiaq Iliqasait, which is our foundation of who we are. And those values do not align with any of this type of work.
A small but vocal group among Nana's 15,000 Inupiaq shareholders agree with her. Schaefer helped craft a survey to gauge how other shareholders felt. More than three-quarters of the roughly 100 respondents said they did not want a Nana subsidiary providing migrant detention services, even if it was profitable work. As one survey respondent put it, quote, "not all money is good money." Acoma and its subsidiaries comprise Nana's federal contracting branch, and they generate a majority of the Alaska Native Corporation's overall profits, according to information presented at a recent shareholder meeting. Charts presented at the meeting showed that Acoma's annual revenue is often higher than that of Nana's Red Dog Mine, one of the world's largest zinc mines, located in northwest Alaska. Nana executives told shareholders at the meeting that Acoma brought in about $2.2 billion last year. Some of those who responded to the survey were unbothered by the recent news reports, which they called fake news. One wrote, quote, "As a Nana shareholder, I am impressed and proud of the work Acoma does, and trust that Acoma employees do their best," end quote. Schaefer says she can't understand that viewpoint. She says there's a certain grim irony to the detentions and deportations, noting that indigenous people were the original occupants of what became the United States.
Every single person who's not indigenous to this land is an immigrant, or they come from immigrants. How do you decipher who you choose to send away? These are inhumane behaviors coming from our contractors. Regardless, it's you're choosing money over humane situation, so money over people.
Nana's communication staff and executive leadership team did not respond to multiple requests for comment. The chair of its board of directors, in a text message, declined to comment. A decades-in-the-making pipeline that would transport natural gas between the North Slope and the Kenai Peninsula now has a new majority owner. That's after the state-run entity in charge of the Alaska LNG mega project announced Thursday it had signed an agreement with outside pipeline developer Glenfarne Group. They'll now take the lead on attracting investors with the goal of landing the Holy Grail, a final investment decision. KDLL's Ashlyn O'Hara reports.
Governor Mike Dunleavy celebrated Thursday's agreement as the closest the $44 billion Alaska LNG project has ever come to fruition.
I don't think we've been closer to a consummation of a pipeline in our history. A lot of us are feeling confidence that this is going to move to a concrete pipeline being built within 2.5 years that will bring gas to Alaskans.
That's Dunleavy speaking to reporters Thursday evening from Tokyo, the latest stop on an East Asian tour to rally support for and promote the project. The agreement signed Thursday gives Glenfarne, which is based out of Houston, Texas, and New York, 75% ownership of the project. The state of Alaska is hanging on to the other quarter. Frank Richards is the president of the Alaska Gasline Development Corporation. He told his board of directors during a special meeting Thursday afternoon, the agreement is the product of a lot of late nights and international teamwork.
We have been bringing the Midnight Oil to move forward and to work on these definitive agreements with Glenfarne.
If it's built, the Alaska LNG project would move natural gas between the North Slope and the Kenai Peninsula. The full project includes a gas treatment plant on the slope, an 800-mile pipeline, and a liquefaction and export facility in Nikiski. Thursday's agreement comes almost 4 months after the Development Corporation said it was in talks with Glenfarne to take over the project. Brendan Duvall is Glenfarne's CEO and founder. He told board members his company is excited about being part of the project.
This really is a tremendous opportunity for the state, for the United States, for our allies, and we couldn't be more thrilled to see the board vote in favor of this transaction.
Duvall told reporters Thursday evening the project is in a, quote, pricing phase. He said they hope to have a final investment decision for the pipeline by the end of the year. It's unclear whether Glenfarne would hang on to its 75% stake if the pipeline isn't ultimately built, since the terms of the deal are confidential. Here's Richards again.
Per the statutes granted to us by the legislature, as a very commercial deal, we have the responsibility to keep it confidential.
As the new owner, Glenfarne's first task will be to update the project's existing cost estimate. Thursday's agreement also says Glenfarne will prioritize the pipeline piece of the project before moving to later phases. That would let Alaska customers access gas before it's available for export. On the same Thursday evening call with reporters, Dunleavy said Alaska is closer than ever to getting the pipeline project off the ground. But he says he understands if people still have doubts about its prospects.
I was very skeptical for years on this project, and I'm not going to have a final celebration. I'll get excited when these guys go into FID. I'll get excited when pipe is ordered. I'll get excited when it's welded. I'll get excited when gas is going through it. I'll really get excited when we flick on the switch and we're guaranteed that's Alaska gas. So I would just say stay tuned.
Though Thursday's decision is a step forward, it's still unclear whether enough investors will sign on for the project to be built. Duvall, the Glenfarne CEO, said the company plans to announce a consortium soon that will focus on finding money for the project. He says the project will be funded with private money, but federal interest may help accelerate the project, such as by keeping tariffs low and protecting existing federal loan guarantees. Reporting in Kenai, I'm Ashlyn O'Hara.
The Alaska legislature passed a bill today designating March as Women's History Month in state law. Backers say it's an effort to recognize the important contributions women have made to Alaska and the nation as a whole. The main sponsor in the House, Democratic Anchorage Representative Carolyn Hall, introduced the bill by reading a long list of notable Alaska women.
Gail Phillips, Vera Alexander, Carol Beery, Ellen Paniok, Nellie Cashman, Elizabeth Paratrovich, Tina DeLapp.
She says some of those names might sound familiar and others may not. But she says all of them paved the way for today's female leaders, and she says all of them deserve recognition.
Mr. Speaker, this is why it's so important for Alaska to honor and preserve Women's History Month. The purpose is to lift up, recognize, and integrate women's experiences into our state's narrative.
This year, for the first time, women outnumber men in the Alaska House of Representatives. Senator L.V. Gray Jackson, an Anchorage Democrat, wrote the bill and carried it through the Senate earlier this month.
Alaska is a land of resilience where survival depends on strength, adaptability, and community. And for generations, women have been at the heart of it all. Leaders, trailblazers, and defenders of culture and justice. Yet too often, their contributions have been overlooked.
The bill passed 19-0 in the Senate and 33-2 in the House. Republican Representatives Julie Colomb of Anchorage and Mike Prox of North Pole were the only lawmakers voting no. Prox and Colomb said after the vote that they thought women should be recognized for their accomplishments rather than their gender. Colomb said designating a month for women's history would not make a meaningful difference in women's lives. Governor Mike Dunleavy's communications director declined to say whether the governor would sign the bill. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a multi-village potlatch in western Alaska is a chance to honor relatives and dance.
All the ugly stuff inside you, you take them out and you dance your head off.
That's ahead. Stay with us. Starting May 7th, every air traveler age 18 and older will need a real ID to board a flight within the United States. Alaska DMV manager Lauren Whiteside says her agency is ready to help any residents who still need to upgrade their ID.
We are ready and willing to issue to anyone and everyone who doesn't have one that wants one.
The Real ID deadline was delayed many times, but the Transportation Security Administration says this upcoming deadline is for real. Whiteside urges travelers who plan to fly on or after May 7th to ensure they have a Real ID. Without one, people may face delays or be denied entry at TSA security checkpoints, preventing them from boarding their flights. Military bases will also require Real IDs for entry starting May 7th. Whiteside says the DMV has already issued Real IDs to many Alaskans.
DMV has been issuing Real IDs for over 6 years now. We started issuing them in January of 2019. We've issued a little over 350,000 unique Real ID credentials since January of 2019.
Whiteside says that the department has provided ample opportunities for Alaskans outside of Anchorage to get Real IDs through mobile units and outreach programs.
DMV does have a mobile DMV unit that does travel to rural Alaska, and we have traveled to several communities over the last few years issuing Real IDs.
If you're unsure if your driver's license is a Real ID, check the top right-hand corner. It will have a star symbol to indicate compliance. If you still need to obtain a Real ID, you can visit your local DMV. For more information, visit dmv.alaska.gov. The Trump administration announced Thursday it would shrink U.S. Department of Health and Human Services staff by almost a quarter, and it has suggested that it will dissolve the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention division that focuses on HIV prevention. Amid the uncertainty, Alaska organizations aren't sure if the federal funding they rely on will still exist. One organization is the Alaskan AIDS Assistance Association, or 4As. Its director, Robin Lutz, says losing federal funding could make the HIV/AIDS epidemic get worse in Alaska and more deadly.
We have the opportunity to end the epidemic. We will not be able to do that if this administration continues to act in the way it has.
In her nearly 30 years working with HIV-positive people, Lutz has seen major improvements to awareness, prevention, and treatment of HIV and AIDS. But losing federal grant funding means the state would lose progress in fighting the disease. The nonprofit helps Alaskans who are HIV-positive with housing and access to life-saving medication. It also helps people get tested to know if they are HIV-positive, which helps curb the spread. Roughly 700 people are living with HIV in the state. Threats to Medicaid could further endanger Alaska's HIV-positive population. The Trump administration plans to cut the federal health department by 25%. Local organizations say there has been little to no information about the impacts these changes will have on federal grants.
Over a third of people living with HIV in the state don't have the resources they need and deserve to manage their health without support. And it's basically economic support.
Lutz says Alaska is a uniquely difficult place to access HIV testing and prevention medications. Accessing preventative care is already a challenge for Alaskans due to misinformation and stigmatization of HIV. Mariners around Kodiak and across coastal Alaska rely on weather data coming from marine buoys to stay safe out on the water. These buoys provide information about water currents, wave height, wind speed, and more. KMXD's Davis Hovey reports that amid shakeups and federal agencies, how that data reaches regular Alaskans could be changing.
Keith Cochran of the Bay Islander checks the marine weather forecast daily before he heads out to fish.
The forecasting has got so good and detailed and precise. I mean, it's a matter of like leaving the dock, you know, 2 hours later or 4 hours later, or slowing the boat down so I get out there at the opportune time.
Cochran, who fishes out of Kodiak and Oregon, is currently fishing for pollock. It's the ubiquitous whitefish's A season in the Gulf of Alaska and is the largest fishery in Kodiak by volume. Cochran scrolls through weather data on his smartphone or on his Time Zero navigation system on his boat. That data is mainly being collected from a network of 3-meter buoys all over Alaska and North America. There are 19 of these weather buoys in Alaska, plus 8 coastal stations on land that record weather data and ocean observations every 10 minutes, 24/7. That data is averaged together over the course of an hour and then transmitted to a satellite that federal agencies pay for. The wider network has roughly 100 weather buoys and 39 tsunami stations across the Atlantic Ocean, the Pacific Ocean, and international waters. The satellite relays the data to the National Data Buoy Center on Mississippi's Gulf Coast. Part of the center's roughly 30 federal employees and about 100 contractors work in shifts 24 hours a day, combing through the data to help forecast marine weather and monitor for tsunamis.
So we've been here almost 50 years, creating a large number of weather buoys, and we've expanded with time. Certainly part of that expansion is with Alaska.
William Burnett directs the center. Some of the center's staff members have quit as part of the Trump administration's fork in the road offer, while others were fired amid sweeping cuts to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, according to reporting from The Columbian, a newspaper in Washington state. Burnett would not say how many, but he says the remaining staff will be able to maintain the nation's weather buoys and deliver marine data.
From the technicians, the engineers who are designing the buoys, the meteorologists, and oceanographers who are analyzing the data and quality controlling it. It's a 24/7 network, so they're always looking at the data.
After that, it's sent to the National Weather Service's global telecommunications system and distributed in real time through smartphone apps, web pages, and NOAA weather radio for anyone, including Cochrane, to access for free. The agency's data online gets 9 million hits a day, according to Burnett. Cochrane says he's starting to see more and more for-profit marine weather products with subscription models and fees. For example, he pays $10 a month in the summer for a service that helps him fish more efficiently.
When you get into sea surface temperature, chlorophyll, temperature at different areas in the water column, those things we would call premium weather options, or they do call them that. And they charge a lot more for them because those are the things that you use to try to go figure out where your fish is going to be or where they're moving or where they're migrating.
There's growing interest from private companies to sell their own marine weather products. Burnett with the National Data Buoy Center says it's not necessarily competitive. He sees opportunities to partner with private companies.
National Data Buoy Center and the National Weather Service operate what we consider to be that backbone foundational network that people can always rely upon to go get observations, but our collaboration with industry partners and the commercial sector will allow us to grow in areas where we may not be able to place observations, and they may be able to collect additional data for us.
But Rick Toman, a former forecaster who worked for the National Weather Service in Alaska for more than 30 years, is skeptical, especially about service to rural Alaska.
Operating in rural Alaska is extremely difficult logistically. And private companies, venture capitalist-funded companies, by definition, are in business to make money. And that's going to be a tough lift in rural Alaska. Could it be done? I guess we'll find out.
In the meantime, Burnett says the center will keep its network of weather buoys, each worth up to $250,000, maintained and operational. The maintenance window for the roughly 100 buoys across North America, including those in Alaska, begins in March and ends in November. Burnett says the center will repair as many buoys as possible in that time frame, and this spring they plan to repair buoys around Kodiak with help from the Coast Guard. Reporting in Kodiak, I'm Davis Havi.
Three Bears Alaska will soon unveil its 31st retail outlet in the state, a 28,000-square-foot grocery store and gas station in Delta Junction. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
Three Bears contractors worked all winter to complete construction of the building that now houses the grocery and a smaller store that'll sell outdoor gear. A company spokesperson says it'll all be open for business any day now.
We are actually set to be fully operational by Monday, but it could be sooner. It's going to depend on some moving parts here. But as of right now, yeah, we are good to go by Monday.
Three Bears marketing manager Chris Carlson says those moving parts include some last-minute work needed on the gas station convenience store on the site that the company bought a year ago. That required emptying the existing gas station's underground fuel storage tanks, so Three Bears cut the price of gas to $1.99 a gallon, and it sold out in 2 days.
They're done. They are dry. And so as soon as the store is open, the new gas pumps will be operational.
Carlson said Thursday that even after the stores open their doors, the company will continue touch-ups around the site in downtown Delta just off the Richardson Highway.
It's going to be more of a soft opening with some sort of grand opening later, probably in early summer.
The new store will be Delta's second grocery. The first is an IGA that opened in 1990 in a structure built in 1958 that housed grocery and department stores over the years. And Carlson says he thinks Delta area residents will appreciate what they find on the Three Bears store's shelves.
Competition's great, and we definitely embrace that. But, as far as the store, I think, it's going to be great for that community.
The Wasilla-based company's chain now includes 14 grocery stores, 14 gas stations, 9 sporting goods stores, and 4 pharmacies all around the state. Company owner Larry Weiss opened his first store in Tok in 1980 and his first store with the Three Bears name in 1989. His son Dave Weiss is now president and CEO. In Delta Junction, I'm Tim Ellis.
The upcoming Chimay Dance Festival in Bethel will honor Angela and Isidore Hunt of Kotlik as living treasures, ambassadors of cultural dance preservation in their community. The two have long been the organizers behind a multi-village traditional potlatch celebration on the Lower Yukon, including one that took place earlier this month. As KYUK's Samantha Watson reports, the celebration honors relatives living and passed on by celebrating the youngest dancers in the room.
In the center of the Kotlik School gym, a single girl dances. She's wearing a handmade blue kusbuk and beaded headpiece. She flicks furred hand fans in time with the drumbeat behind her. Her great-grandparents, Angela and Isidore Hunt, are part of the crowd that surrounds her. The Hunts, who are in their 80s, organized this event. They coordinated with the villages of Stebbins, Amonok, St. Mary's, and Mountain Village. Many in the crowd traveled for hours by snow machine to gather here at this three-day celebration. The heart of it, what's taking place right now on this first night of the potlatch, called Chokhorok in Yupik, is the presentation of Kotlik's first dancers. Julia Hooch is among the crowd. She grew up in Amonok and traveled from Wasilla to attend the Chokhorok.
You take out all your anger, all the ugly stuff inside you, you take them out and you dance your head off. And that's how you take your sins away. That's what they always say a long time ago.
The Chokhorok celebrations are hosted this time of year in each of these Lower Yukon communities, bringing together relatives in a weekend of dancing and subsistence food gifting. Branches of the Hunt family pass out gifts of sweet treats and handmade items to relatives of the girl's Yupik namesake. Traditionally, that Yupik name honors an elder who has passed away around the time of the child's birth. Angela Hunt says so much of Chokhorok is about feeling your family in the room with you, even those who have passed on.
Spirits of those people that passed, they come to by spirits and be there the whole time.
The weekend's festivities also honor the living. On the second day of the Chokhorok, all three villages gather in Kotlik's community hall. Hunks of moose meat, frozen fish, and jars of seal oil are piled onto tarps in the middle of the room. After a blessing, the meat is divided into bags and passed out to elders of the visiting communities. Anna Moore flew in from Nome, but grew up in the area. She says she'd spent many years away from the celebrations, but returned when she heard a dancer named after her grandmother would be presented.
I'm experiencing a spiritual awakening. I mean, it's unexplainable. It's more beautiful than beautiful. I'm still processing. And it's part of identity, the traditional identity of who we are.
Each January, Angela and Isidore begin coordinating between the village communities and organizing Kotlik's community Yorok rehearsals. For as long as anyone can remember, the Hunts have kept this gathering alive. For the Hunts, it's all about connectedness, and the beating heart of that is family. Here's Angela translating for Isidore again.
He was happy for our great-grandkids' first dance while we're living. And you see, he was so happy seeing them.
During the first night of the Chokochok, Isidore leaves the drummers behind his great-granddaughter as she continues her first dance. And then comes a call in a song. All at once, the lone dancer is surrounded as four generations of the Hunt family in matching blue kusbucks rush to the floor to join her. In Kotlik, I'm Samantha Watson.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org and wherever you get your podcasts. We had reports tonight from Ashlyn O'Hara in Kenai, Eric Stone in Juneau, Cadence Cedars in Anchorage, Yvonne Crumrie in Juneau, Davis Hovey in Kodiak, Tim Ellis in Delta Junction, and Samantha Watson in Kotlik. Our audio engineer is Chris Hyde. Annie Feit helped produce tonight's show, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.